The vision continues to progress and ultimately to a very powerful climax coming in just a moment. In chapter 18, we really begin to see a more elaborate detail of the destruction that is to come upon those who oppose God. The impending doom upon Babylon. It is becoming more obvious with every verse, with every statement, as this vision progresses. The scene, in some ways, in chapter 18, would be quite difficult to comprehend. As we've observed through this class, this last quarter and a half, this is about the Roman Empire. This is Christians facing persecution at their hands, and so it pertains to them. Now imagine, just for a moment, a behemoth nation and city structure like the Roman Empire. What could possibly bring it to its knees? What could possibly bring it down? As it is so beyond comprehension, its reach, its power, its influence, its seeming stability. What could make it come down? It seemed invincible. The vision has actually depicted that in multiple ways. As we've seen the way the dragon depicted, of course the dragon himself being Satan, but the way the dragon empowered the beast, both from the sea and from the land, they're depicted in ways that would bring to mind their invincibility. And so who could bring this monstrosity down? Well, Revelation 18, folks, is the collapse of a highly civilized civilization. That's what's going on in chapter 18. The point is, Rome is coming down. It will not be brought down by evil itself. It will be, in some ways, brought down by its own evil. But it will be brought down ultimately because of the justice of God. The justice of God Himself. The first eight or so verses describe to an extent the fall of Babylon the Great. Let's go ahead and begin. We'll read these eight verses and then we'll pick it apart. Verse 1, Revelation 18, verse 1. And after these things I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen, and has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. Render to her just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her words. In the cup which she has mixed, mix for her double. As much as she has glorified herself and lived luxuriously, so much torment and sorrow give her. For she says in her heart, I sit as queen, and am no widow, and will not see sorrow. Therefore her plagues will come in one day, death, mourning, and famine. And she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. After these things, verse 1, that is not a reference to time. It is a reference to a sequential order. The things that just took place in chapter 17, now as it unfolds in more detail. We have the beast introduced in chapter 17. We have the beast introduced earlier than that, chapter 13, and really, even back in chapter 11 briefly. We have the harlot introduced in chapter 17. And as the vision continues to reiterate, these are really one and the same. They are not separate entities, they are not separate beings, but they are the same. They are the pinnacle of ungodliness, of those who oppose God. And so the scene begins to unravel their fall as they would be brought low. Another angel in verse 1. John says, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. Notice this, having great authority. Another angel typically indicates that this is another angel being of the same rank or of the same order as some of the predecessors we've already seen in the vision. But this one is noticeably different because he has great authority. He is one who possesses great authority. If you didn't put your phone on Do Not Disturb, now would be a good time to do it. And I'm only saying that by random happenstance. It was a joke. I just got a text or something. But I didn't read it, just so you know. I wouldn't have had time. So here's this angel who possesses great authority. Now, notice he possesses this authority by God. He has the authority to act and to do things on God's behalf as he carries out the divine judgment that will continue through this particular chapter. See at the very end of verse 1, the earth was illuminated with his glory. The earth illuminated with his glory. That's an indication of the greatness of this angel and the greatness of his mission. Okay? He illuminates as he carries out God's will. In verse 2, he cries mightily with a loud voice, this solid, sure, absolute, authoritative statement, this bold proclamation. He cries with this voice. Notice what he says. Babylon the Great is fallen, is fallen. This would be the shocking statement that would begin the unfolding of the events in this particular chapter. It is stated as an already accomplished fact. Now that is awesome. Babylon will fall. See, that's a whole different thing. It's not what it says. It says Babylon is fallen. Is fallen. It's coming down, and it is sure. The surety of this event is God Himself. God speaks it, and His name carries authority. Isaiah himself, back in Isaiah chapter 21 and verse 9, made a similar proclamation of the literal city of Babylon when he made the statement, Babylon is fallen, is fallen. Again, Isaiah 21 verse 9, Babylon the city stood, Babylon the empire stood, but Isaiah declared it as an absolute, already happened fact. And so the vision here reminds us of that. It is reminiscent of that. Both of these two entities, the Babylonian Empire of old, the literal Babylonian Empire, and the figurative Babylonian Empire, which really was the Roman Empire in the book of Revelation, they were very similar to one another. Both world-ruling empires of their day, both known for their power, for their luxurious living, for their influence, for their wealth, and for their overrunning pleasures. Both empires typified that very, very well. Both completely ungodly. Both bent against God and against God's way of doing things and against God's authority and were seemingly invincible. Nobody thought the Babylonian Empire would fall. No Christian in the first century thought the Roman Empire would fall. They parallel one another. They parallel one another as God declares both will come down. I want you to see this. Now, we're already somewhat familiar with the historical context of this book. In Revelation chapter 18, verse 2, it says that it is fallen, and has become a habitation of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird. One thing Rome was known for, and I've said it about seven times already, was their luxurious living. You wanted for nothing if you were a well-off citizen of the Roman Empire. Now I'll save this for just a second later. But they wanted for nothing. They had it all. It was luxurious living, it was wealth, it was pleasure. But notice the contrast. That city is no more. It is fallen, and now it is a habitation. It is a dwelling place of awfulness. It is made desolate. It wants for everything and has nothing. It is a place of demons, a prison for foul spirits, a cage for birds, unclean and hated. Boy, it's just poetic, but it's reiterating. This place went from up here to absolutely the worst of the worst of the worst. And that's the idea it's expressing. Babylon is no more. By the way, as this vision continually contrasts these images, you've got Babylon the Great, who is great no more. Then you've got the city of God, His people, His dwelling place, where they look like they're going to be defeated, where it looks pretty awful, but where does the vision end? With the city of God shining forth in all its glorious splendor. It's a contrast. You stand with God, you live in His city of refuge and provision. Powerful terminology and powerful allusions here. Verse 3, for all the nations, this is Revelation 18 and verse 3, for all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. Now, it's very clear. We're talking about a city, but he continually personifies this city, as he did in chapter 17 when he introduced her as a harlot. Well, he's using some of that same terminology here. Misery loves company, folks. That's not a surprise. What so often is a surprise and really should not be is sin loves company. Misery and sin go hand in hand. They're reflections of each other. And sin loves company, folks. Verse 3 really in so many ways illustrates that point very well. It should be no surprise to us that she brought all company to her that would possibly come. And she could seduce them that way because she presented it in such a appealing way. Notice this, the nations have drunk the wine of the wrath of her fornication. This angel will continue to elaborate on this drunken fornication that this woman commits with the nations around her as this chapter unfolds. They were just fine. They were content to go to bed with her as long as it lined their pockets, as long as they received something from it. Political gain, financial gain, religious gains, whatever it may have been, they were just fine going to bed with her as long as it helped them. And folks, she was good at her job. She seduced all realms of society. And as chapter 18 unfolds, we'll see this again come up later, but I want you to see this in verse 3. So it says the kings of the earth committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. So already we're seeing this depicted. All realms of society went to bed with her. She seduced them all. They would not deny her advances. They went with her, right down from the kings who ruled the nations to the merchants who were the backbone of those nations. All peoples were bought in to what she offered. Now, notice this in verse 3. Seems the vision shifts slightly while he continues to elaborate on the point at hand. He says, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins and lest you receive of her plagues. Some of the observations we've made all this time, it is not clear who the speaker is. Now, we can safely know that it's still from God. It's still God warning His people as John hears another voice. And the statement is, come out of them. Come out of, as he says there, out of her, my people. Don't buy into what she's selling. Don't be seduced by what she's offering. You, kind of tying into what we said in chapter 17, you be wise. You see the end, the inevitable end of what she offers. This is the authority of God speaking, folks. Whether it's an angel or whether it's from the throne itself, it is God. And so the plea is flee. Flee. F-L-E-E. Yeah, because it rhymed with plea and never mind. That's two different fleas. But flee. Run. Get out. Be gone. By the way, folks, this was not a literal anything. This was not God really telling the people, get out of Rome. Run from Rome. That's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is escape her influence. Run. Get out from among those people. Don't buy into that seductive reasoning. Don't buy into that temporality and those lustful behaviors. Go. This is the plea throughout the Scriptures. Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldeans in Genesis 12. Lot was called out of Sodom and Gomorrah. Israel was called out of Egypt in Exodus 3. Christians in 2 Corinthians 6 are called out of this world. We're to leave and flee from these temptations, not buy in to them. You have to live in this world. We all have to face this world and what this world offers. But there's a difference between living in this world and condoning, accepting, and approving the sins of this world. There's a difference between those two things, folks. And we need to make sure we understand that. You got to see it in this world. You got to live around it. But that doesn't mean you've got to pat it on the back and say it's A-okay and keep doing it. There's the difference. It will always be a temptation, as it was for them, to simply do what is easiest. The statement in verse 4 was not an easy statement, folks. It was not an easy statement to accept when he says, "Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, lest you receive of her plagues. Come out of her." You know how difficult that must have been? To live in a world so given over to immorality and yet not give in to it. You want to talk about challenging, but that was the plea of God. If you choose the easy path, it will not lead to your salvation. In fact, it more often than not will lead to your utter ruin and your destruction. And so he says, come out of her. Don't take the easy path. Notice verse 5. As he continues to elaborate in many ways why they need to get out of her, he says in verse 5, "For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities." One thing that is not as obvious, but we certainly need to see in the book of Revelation, is the long-suffering of God, the patience of God. The book, in many ways, is a statement of God's patience as it stands. Warning, 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 warning. Okay, you waited too late. It's done. That's what the book of Revelation is, the whole time, warning these people. Well, here's what God's talking about in verse 5. Her sins have reached heaven. There will come a point, no matter how long this happens, there will come a point where God has finally said, enough. I can stomach it no more. Iniquities reaching up to heaven. You can only pile sin so high before it reaches the nostrils of God and He is abhorred against it. And so, the statement in verse 5, God remembered her iniquities. It's not that he forgot. God misplaced it for a moment or something. I just forgot and now he's remembering now. No. It's that God is taking action. And so, the book of Revelation certainly reminds us of that. In verse 6, render to her just as she rendered to you, and repay her double according to her works in the cup which she has mixed for her double. She has been responsible for so much violence, so much hatred, animosity, sin, so many lives lost both physically and spiritually, and now the tables will be turned back against her. She'll have to face it herself. Receive back upon herself what she has spread. Now, this is very much a sowing and reaping principle. You can only sow so much violence, hatred, animosity, temptations, carnality, temporality, lust, and awfulness before the harvest comes and you reap what you've sown. That happens to nations too. Which, in a point, is some of the stuff Revelation's getting at. This is not just about individuals, this is about nations. That's who he's speaking to, is the nation of Rome, the Roman Empire. Render to her. That's the Roman Empire. Render to her, just as she rendered to you. Now the idea is not that, it's just double the amount of judgment. No, it's that the scales of justice will be balanced. For all the hatred she spread, the judgment and justice of God will be absolutely equal to it, poured upon her. You see some of this terminology, it's quite powerful. She attempted to strangle the world on the blood of the saints through her chalice. Here, God is saying, it's finally over. Enough is enough. The cup which she has mixed, that chalice of the blood of the saints, the cup which she has mixed, mix it for her double. It's coming back on her head. She has done enough. Now here's the deal. She'll get exactly what is due her. One of the overall themes of the book is God's justice. By the way, as God executes justice, by contrast, there will be no more injustice. That would be a comfort to those Christians in the first century. Verse 7. As much as she has glorified herself and lived luxuriously, so much torment and sorrow give her. For she says in her heart, I sit as queen and am no widow, and will not see sorrow. While she experienced this fine living and all of this enjoyment, this glorifying herself and luxuriousness, she was committing absolute atrocities. She was spreading torment and sorrow, is the phrase used here. But not only did she spread those things, she also spread arrogance and the delusional idea of invincibility, as she thought herself untouchable. Her pride consumed her. I sit as queen. I am no widow, and I will not see sorrow. Her delusional invincibility. I appreciate poetry, and so some of these phrases, the poetry is just leaking off the pages, folks. But I'm going to pocket that for just a second. While she thought herself royal and splendid, she was so much like ancient Babylon that John's vision calls her Babylon. We're not going to look at it, but Isaiah 47, verses 7 through 11, Isaiah talks about the ancient city, the ancient nation of Babylon, doing the same thing, who thought herself so successful, and God said, you're going back to widowhood. Widowhood. Okay, so now I'll connect all the poetry, because this is awesome. Here's this woman who thinks herself royal. She's a princess, folks. She's a princess. She thinks herself royal. She thinks herself the queen. She thinks that she is untouchable and invincible and loved and admired by all. But what is she really? She's a harlot. Do you see the poetry now? She's a harlot. There's nothing dignified in who she is and what she's doing. There's nothing royal about who she is or what she's doing. There's nothing powerful or impressive or invincible about her seducing the nations and seducing the kings and seducing the merchants to lay in her bed of awfulness. She's a harlot. And that's all she is. Now, does the Christian have the wisdom to see that? Does the Christian have the wisdom to see her for who she is? Riches, wealth, temporality, those things are deceiving. They are deceiving. They can make you delusional, as this woman is, or was. Past tense is probably more appropriate. As she was. The vision reminds us something. And I know we've, seems like the introduction was about 8 years ago. But in the introduction, we talked about one of the main themes of this book is the danger of materialism. That's what we're looking at in chapter 18. The materialistic mindset that was so pervasive among those first century people and Christians who struggled with it. The vision reminds us, don't go to bed with materialism, because you wake up with a harlot. Verse 8, and then we'll open this up. Actually, I've got a couple thoughts I want to share with you from verse 8. In a question form, verse 8 though. So therefore, her plagues will come in one day, death, mourning, and famine, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. Therefore, one of my favorite words in the Scriptures, it connects everything that comes after it with everything that was said before it. Here's what we're driving at. this verse is here explaining and making the conclusive remark about what preceded it. Because of that state of degradation, that state of delusional arrogance and pride and hoisting itself up against God, her plagues will come. She's going to face the consequences of her immorality. And so he says the plagues will come in one day. In one day. It does not mean that Rome will literally fall in one day or as in 1 hour, which he used earlier and he'll use again in a few verses. But it's the fact that it will surely go down. It will happen. He says death and famine, or death, mourning, and famine. She's going to go down. One thing that's pretty fascinating about this contrast between the world's vantage point and heaven's vantage point. To the world, the fall of Rome would take a while. But from God's standpoint, it's an hour. It's not going to last that long at all. It's practically over. And as he says, Babylon is fallen. Babylon is fallen. This momentary act will be as if it has already occurred. The specific plagues mentioned in verse 8 are in contrast, in a stark contrast, I might say, of the euphoria this woman experienced in her arrogance. So she thought royal, she thought luxury, she thought fun and frivolity, and the vision says, no, what you're getting is death, mourning, and famine. No more luxury, no more parties, no more living it up. Death, mourning, and famine. So, to further illustrate the full calamity of this city and of this woman, verse 8 says, and she will be utterly burned with fire, for strong is the Lord God who judges her. Some strong terminology. Some commentators say this can't be the Rome of John's day because two reasons. Number one, Rome was never burned with fire, or at least it wasn't after the Christians did it in the 60s or early mid-60s, according to Nero. That was probably a super confusing sentence. Let me try to pretty that up a little bit. So the Christians were accused of burning the city in the mid-60s by Nero. Okay, but after that date, the Rome city was never burned like what this verse is describing. So that's one reason why some people say this can't be Rome. And the other reason is they say, well, Rome still stands. Verse 8 says that she will be utterly burned with fire. That is almost complete desolation. Now, this may be an unfair question with how much I explained all that just now, but I'm going to ask it anyways. How can this still be Rome? If I had a hat on right now, I'd tip it. Absolutely. I'll just settle to a generous bow, Dennis. I don't have a hat to tip. It's exactly the point. We're not looking at the literal city of Rome. We never have been, folks. In the whole vision, we've not been looking at the literal city of Rome. But we have been looking at the figurative city of Rome, what the city represents, what it certainly stands for. This is figurative language because it is apocalyptic. I haven't said that yet, so count yourself pretty lucky tonight. But it is. It's apocalyptic language. This is not about a literal burning of the city. And by the way, as Dennis so admirably pointed out, the Lord never promised to destroy the literal city. What he did promise was to destroy the mindset, to destroy the influence, to destroy the power, to destroy the scope and the reach. Her buildings will continue to stand. But the Rome of John's day, she is absolutely 100% no more. 1 second, Phyllis. Go ahead, Dennis. Yeah. You know, it is fascinating why why some ancient civilizations, God said, you're going down and it's going to be absolute. And now even archaeology can't find them. And then in other cities like Rome, still stands. And might I say, still successful. But I'm going to say something on that more in just a second. Phyllis, did you have something? To an extent, yes. To an extent, yes. So there are times where I have been referring to ancient literal Babylon. Yeah, yeah. But I am, for the most part, the rest of the time, unless I specify like that, I'm generally switching those out interchangeably because they're synonymous in the vision. Okay? Even though the name Rome is never used in this vision. But I'm using Rome and the city of Babylon interchangeably because that's what we're looking at. I want to share this with you. Rome was never fully destroyed. We already know that it still exists today. In fact, and this is one of those things that's kind of fascinating, even many of the buildings, many may be a stretch, several of the buildings that would have been standing in John's day are still standing in Rome today. You can go to the city of Rome and still see buildings that were actually there before John's day. But, John, Rome is no longer a superpower. Folks, it was the superpower of the day. There was nobody who could oppose Rome. It isn't that way now. Rome is a nobody. Rome is a nothing. The 4th century, the capital city was moved from Rome to Constantinople, and many invasions from the northern territorial tribes and so forth brought the empire to its ruin completely in 476 AD. But here's what's so fascinating about this historically. The nation of the Roman Empire, the city of Rome, after the vision, in all respects, declined drastically. So this would have been from around 90, 95. The population of John's day, the population of Rome in John's day would have been around 1 million people. So at the time of the vision, around 1 million people. Population of Rome 2,000 years later is about 20,000. The city, just the city itself. Now, I still realize there's a lot more that goes beyond that, but still. I'm sorry, not 20,000 today. I was sitting there thinking, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right. Because I think my numbers is off. 20,000 in the Middle Ages. That's more accurate. And if you're not a big Roman historian buff, then you can't correct me right now. And don't pull out Google. I'll know you checked. So yes, the Lord was strong against her. Appreciate that terminology. It's very into verse 8. The Lord was strong who judged her. So she thought herself untouchable, but her sins had made it very plain, very obvious. She was not strong at all. It was a facade. And God brought her down. Anybody have any questions on that section? This next section, the world who mourns Babylon's fall, beginning in verse 9. We'll take this a few verses at a time. Verse 9, the kings of the earth who have committed fornication and lived luxuriously with her will weep and lament for her when they see the smoke of her burning, standing at a distance for fear of her torment, saying, alas, alas, the great city Babylon, that mighty city, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. All classes of peoples who had profited from her are going to lament her demise in this chapter. We have the kings in verses 9 and 10. We have merchants in verses 11 through 16. In verse 17 through 20, we have sea traders. All peoples will mourn her demise. The kings, verse 9, of the earth. Of the earth. As we've seen this throughout the vision, we've seen that these are earth dwellers. These are those who really stand against God. These are those who accept the earthly viewpoint and they reject the heavenly viewpoint. And through the vision, God is asking Christians, take the heavenly viewpoint. See it from God's perspective. So here are these kings, these earth dwellers. I love this poetic nature. These are those people who snuggled up to this woman of the night, and they went to bed with her. They were just fine, comforting themselves in her care and in her presence. But now, verse 9, they see her smoke from a distance. Verse 10, and they stay at a distance. You see the powerful contrast once more? Now they were just fine going to bed with her in chapter 17, and even early in chapter 18, but now that they're seeing her demise, I don't want to go to bed with her anymore. I want to just kind of stay back here and watch her burn. Well, that's what we're looking at. They don't want anything to do with her now. The problem was, no matter how much distance they tried to put between them and her, they're going down with her because they went to bed with her in the first place. By the way, they're not mourning the fall of Rome in general. They're mourning the calamity of their own financial security. These who profited from her. New American Standard in verse 10 has, instead of alas, alas, it has woe, woe. Of course, the idea reflected earlier, a few chapters, is just how great this burning is, how great this destruction is. And once more, we're reminded, verse 10, for in 1 hour your judgment has come. 1 hour. From the viewpoint of God, this is brief. From their standpoint, this was going to last a while. Something that's kind of fascinating about this, as you try to accrue wealth, it doesn't happen overnight. Here are these kings. They made a profit on this harlot. They made a living. They lived luxuriously. And it happened over a time, but in powerful contrast, all the time that it took them to make that money, in 1 hour, God's taking it all down. He is dismantling their world as they saw it. This is sudden and sure. Verse 11. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. We'll stop there for just a second. Once more, they're mourning, they're weeping, they're lamenting her demise, but it even says it now in verse 11, because no one buys their merchandise anymore. Are they that concerned about her? No. She acted like a harlot, she seduced them like a harlot, and they valued her like a harlot. She's gone. So what? But my pocketbook has been hurt in this process. I am poor for it. So they mourn. Once more, it is the merchants of the earth in verse 11. That's probably not a blanket statement to include all merchants who actually dwell on the earth or live on the earth. More than likely, it's those who were earth dwellers, like we've already seen so far. They are those who are anti-God, anti-Christian, and anti-righteousness. They are corrupt. And so, given to their temporality, they mourn. Verse 12. Merchandise of gold and silver, precious stones and pearls, fine linen and purple, silk and scarlet, every kind of citron wood, every kind of object of ivory, every kind of object of most precious wood, bronze, iron, and marble. We'll stop there for a second. So, Brother Haley in his commentary made an analogous here, or said it was modeled after Ezekiel's description of Tyre's downfall in Ezekiel 26 verse 1 through Ezekiel 28 verse 19. They're the same flavor of chewing gum, if you'll catch my expression here. Okay, but that shouldn't surprise us, as the judgment language typically is. I want you to see this. Verse 12, the gold, silver, precious stones, pearls, fine linen, purple silk, and scarlet. What do all those things have really in common with each other? What are they products of? The lifestyle of the rich and famous? That's what they all have in common. It's all products of wealth. All products that reflect luxury. Merchandise sold, bought, traded, and profited off of. All things to get rich and extremely rich off of. I've got a few more observations I want to make in that section, but we'll wrap it up there. Does anybody have any questions or comments on anything we've talked about tonight? All right. We'll pick up with verse 12 and go through the rest of the chapter on Sunday. Look forward to seeing it, guys.